Okay, I have 4 o'clock, so let's get going. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So it's, I think, when I was talking yesterday in the sutta class, I was mentioning how the four focuses of how the meditation on the breath fulfills the four focuses of mindfulness. It was from the Satipatthana, from the Anapanasati Sutta, and went to the experiences of jhana in the mindfulness of breathing, not going totally into what the jhanas meant, but just to complete the steps of Anapanasati, that we have the last four of exploring impermanence. Just in, have you got that on the screen? What's this? The four jhanas, just, if you go up a little bit, just when you learn to experience impermanence in the breath, that's just the last part of the, at 108, yeah. Four family, okay, just down a tiny bit. Just go above there. There we go. Not too far. Go a bit, sort of, put the text further up. That's my model. There we go. Just there. Yeah. Page 43. Here we go. And when you learn to explore the impermanence in breath meditation, explore things fading away, things ceasing, explore relinquishing things in breath meditation. And those are the last four steps of the breath meditation Anapanasati. And this, the impermanence, first of all, anicca. Now, anicca is one of those words which many people learn in meditation courses and retreats. But because I learnt my Pali first when I had to research the monks Vinaya, the training rules, the history behind that was, as Western monks, that sometimes we didn't fully understand the Vinaya. This was the rules we were supposed to live by. And so that I was actually asked, because I had a brain and knew my Latin and the conjugations and past participle perfect and all that sort of stuff, that they asked me to, can you just learn some Pali and also learn some of the Vinaya. So it was a wonderful eye-opener to learn Pali. Anyone who's ever learned Latin, as you used to have to do in those days in schools, that first of all, I remember just on one of the school desks in the classroom where we learned Latin, someone had scribbled the words on the school desk. It was a poem. Latin is a language as dead could be. First it killed the Romans, now it's killing me. I don't remember that one. But it was helpful, and because it made it very easy to understand and learn Pali. And then when you read these words in the Vinaya is where you have examples of what actually happened, stories of real life. And there you saw many of these words used in such a way you had a deeper understanding of what they really meant. And one of those words was anicca, and its opposite, which was nicca. And this was important for the meals which came to monks and nuns. So, for example, if when you go back to England, you find there's somebody who actually always brings food to you every Monday. Just like over in Bodhinyana Monastery. On Wednesday, there are some people that always come on Wednesday to feed us. They've been coming for years on Wednesday, to the point where if I see them, I know it must be Wednesday today. That's how regular they are. And that is called nicca food. Regular supply. Coming once a week, or once a fortnight, or once a month. It used to be even today, not used to be, it is today the tradition in many Sri Lankan monasteries, that a whole family reserves, you know, the third of every month or something. And so they come to the monastery and they just look after everything on that day. So that's like the regular supply of food. And what that means is that, you know, if you are in a temple, at least you know that day, you don't have to worry about food because that family are always going to come on that day. You just have to fill in the other holes. And that was called nicca food. Regular. Something you can rely upon. Something which is always there. And anicca meant something which was regular, certain, always there, is now gone. As Ajahn Chah used to sometimes call it, the anicca was like minaya, uncertain. Whereas nicca was certainty. And that's one of the reasons why that when I told that story of the tadpole and the water, things which are always there, you can't see. But when something which was regular, always present, sometimes disappears, then you fully understand them. Any one of you who've lost a mother or a father, you know, through death, they're always there, you take them for granted, but one day, yeah, you know they're going to die one day, but when they actually do go, something which was always there, a support, a resource for you, is gone, they're not there anymore. That's anicca, unreliable. There one moment, and now not there. And then you can appreciate what they were. So we're doing the breath meditation. That's how we understand anicca. Something always there, even like your health. It's one of the conceits of being healthy. And even though you are healthy today, who knows what might happen tomorrow? Irrespective of age, or gender, or how much you exercise. So sometimes we think, oh, we're healthy, we can do anything. Especially when you're young. And you see young people doing all sorts of stupid things, as if they're indestructible. So this is where it becomes a wake-up call for us. That even breath meditation can disappear. It's not reliable. And you also see things fading away. That is the viraga. And it's a legitimate translation. If you look in any dictionary, you say that's one of the possibilities for that word. Things disappearing. Things which were there are now no longer there. And sometimes you can see this is part of the process of things vanishing, being unreliable. You can't always count on them. Which means that your body, that even sound. And if ever you see, like sometimes you've got a sickness, and sometimes it fades away, disappears. You don't know why. That's its nature to fade. And sometimes things ceasing. It's the whole idea that whatever is of nature to arise, is of the nature to cease. And you see all of these different things which you always thought were regular, ceasing. your all of your five khandhas, components of existence, your body, you see it fading away. All of, sometimes I wonder, all of that hard work I did learning theoretical physics. I know some of the gist of it, but a lot of it has just faded away from me. There's a couple of people here who know French. I used to be fluent in French. I remember going over to France, hitchhiking and just being able to talk with anybody about anything. But now most of that is just in some corner of my mind, unused, rusted shut, and I can't remember much of it. Even, believe it or not, my Thai was fluent. Ajahn Chah would ask me to translate for him. And I could give Dharma talks in Thai and be invited back again. Please give another talk, you're a great teacher in Thai. But then coming over to Australia after about 36 years now, after about 18, 20 years, I had the experience of a group of people from Thailand came and asked me to give a Dharma talk, which I was very happy here in Australia, in Thai language. I said, no, I haven't used it for such a long time. Oh, please, you know, give it a try. So I gave a talk, a Dharma talk in Thai, for about 20 minutes. And afterwards I saw the audience so excited. Sadhu, 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 amazing. And I was quite surprised what you understood it. Well, we didn't sort of understand it, but it's the first time we've ever heard a talk in Pali. Oh, that was such a downer. I thought I communicated with them in Thai language. They didn't understand a word of it, and they thought I was giving a talk in Pali language. So you can see that all of those skills, they tend to disappear after a while. So, and then you explore relinquishing things in breath meditation, just voluntarily letting things go, being free, not having too many burdens you have to carry around with you. And so you can hear the word I use for contemplate. I use the word explore. Contemplation is a little bit too much thinking. Explore is something different. I will now give you an example of exploration, how insight happens. But I would need you to actually to say things here. What is this which I'm holding up in my hand? Come on, say something. It's a stick. What else is it? Come on. Wood. What else do you see?
Carved wood.
What else do you see?
One part is round.
Yes. What else do you see?
It's brown.
What else? Now, there's no right answer. I'm not going to, when somebody finally says something, say, yes, you've got it, congratulations, you win the prize. There's no right answer. This is an exercise in exploring. We give it all the names, and then, when we've run out of names, we can start to see this in a new way. All those names, a stick, gong, brown, that's actually just old knowledge. To explore new ways of looking at things, you hold it up until you've run out of words, and then you start to see new things which you haven't seen before. You're actually exploring the nature of this. And I was very impressed that this is also, where's he gone? It was a Zen stick from my teddy bear. It had it in here when I came in here. Like the Zen stick which Zen masters use in case any other teddy bears sort of, and actually there's one over there who's nodding, at least his head is drooping. But it's seeing things in a new light. It's not your old understanding. One of the other sayings which I'd like is never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. All of your learning takes you so far. And then truth, the experience right in front of you, sometimes that it can't be true because the books don't say it. Because I'm told this is not true. But there it is, right in front of you. Now I'm going to get weird. Aliens. Do you believe that aliens from other planets exist? It's weird stuff. But I remember just giving a talk in Nolamara about aliens. And I got many stories, and one in particular was really freaky. Because it was one of the Anagarikas in this monastery a few years ago who told me the story that his girlfriend, that before, that she always claimed that earlier in her life that she was abducted. It's weird. But she could speak a language, a weird language. And she said she learned it from some alien or something. And people thought, that's crazy. But the Anagarika said that it was such a weird language that they found out on some website that only one other person in the world could speak this language. And they were actually from Portugal. Yeah, I mean, probably another part of Portugal. Because Helen lives in Portugal. But anyway, the TV crews were interested because this was a story. And there was the TV presenter, I think, George Negus, I think. He's supposed to be a famous TV presenter over here in Australia. So he was commissioned to check this out. So the TV crews, they decided to take this woman, it was a girlfriend of one of the Anagarikas, before he became an Anagarika, took her over to Portugal, and these two people had a conversation. They both claimed they were abducted, and they tested it out as much as they possibly could. These two women, human beings, were communicating. And he said this was weird, and later on, well, that's right, it was his girlfriend at that time. He was not a Anagarika yet. And then he said one day, they're in good relationship together when they come back to Perth. One day his girlfriend just went out to the shops to get some bread or some milk or something and never came back. And after that he became an Anagarika. And that's not a joke, it's a true story. And because it was told by an Anagarika keeping 8 precepts, stayed with him for a year, sometimes I thought, wow, you know, that's got credibility. There's no reason why he should make that up. Especially because it checks out about the TV program and stuff. Weird. It's got nothing to do with jhanas and getting enlightened, by the way. But all it is like exploring, having the ability to actually to take a subject and not be sort of cut it out, stop it, and put barriers. It can't be true. It's impossible. But sometimes these things do happen. They are true. So that's exploration. It really is keeping an open mind. Not being gullible, as many people can be, but just keeping that open mind. It's called exploring the Dhamma, seeing what is possible. Anyway, that was the last part of the Anapanasati. And now I am going to just go forward to the jhanas, if you would, Eileen, the right stillness. And thank you. And for even the translation of samadhi as stillness, of all the translations which, you know, I have tried to insert into old terms, that is one of the terms which I'm just most, if you like, passionate about. Because when it was concentration, it caused me a lot of problems as a young monk. So much trying, so much stress. And of course, you know, I had willpower like many other people do. Some people had much more willpower than I did. But even though sometimes I try to concentrate on the tip of my nose, and what happened? Tension headaches. And even when I first went to Malaysia to teach, so many people were complaining about samadhi headache. And when I was in Thailand, you didn't have samadhi headache, samadhi bliss, yeah. But samadhi headache, meditation headache, that was weird. Until, you know, I found out they were all trying to focus their attention on the tip of the nose. And it soon became very clear why people get samadhi headache when they concentrate, use force on the tip of the nose. And to be able to explain this, I take my spectacles off. So you can clearly see my eyes, my eyeballs, and I'm now going to focus on the tip of the nose with my eyelids open. And if you can see what happens to my eyeballs, and if I carry on like this for 5 minutes, I'm going to get a tension headache up here. And unfortunately, that's what people do. They don't realize that they've got their eyelids closed, but because their mind focuses here, it's their eyes follow and look there as well, which is one of the reasons why samadhi headache. And for me, the concentration, missing so much. Concentration is actually focusing on where you want to be. Stillness is letting go of everything which is opposing you, in your way. It's not holding on to something. It's letting go of all the impediments and hindrances. You know, sometimes that we talk about two words, let go and let be. Which one should you do? Let go or let be? Obviously, you let go of all the things which hinder the meditation. Let go of the past and the future. Let go of thinking. Let go of even judging. Let go of wanting to attain things. And whatever's left, let that be. So, some things you let go of, and what's remaining, you let that be. And of course, it's there, it's still, it doesn't move. It is stillness. So anyway, that's why I prefer that meaning, stillness, rather than concentration. And of course, you know, saw me do the simile of the cup. I wonder where Claire's gone. She must be in jhana. But when you put the cup down, the only way, that becomes still all by itself. But it only moves because something outside of it moves. Ajahn Chah said this was the default state of the mind. His simile, because I haven't said this yet, he didn't use a cup simile. He put his hand up and he waved it up and down in front of us. I saw him do this so many times. Wave it up and down, and he said, this is a leaf on a tree or on a bush. It only moves because of the wind. If the wind stops, the leaf moves less and less. It doesn't stop, it's not still yet. It moves less and less and less until after a time, if you're patient enough and the wind doesn't blow, then the leaf comes to perfect stillness all by itself. Because that's its natural state, to be still. It only moves because something outside of it makes it move. Its default state is stillness. And that's what he said the human mind is like. The human mind is naturally still. But because something outside of it, the wind of wanting, wanting something different, wanting to be somewhere else, that wind of wanting is what moves your mind. And if You can keep that winds of wanting away from your mind. Sit here not wanting anything in the whole world, content and easily satisfied. Then your mind slows down all by itself. You don't do it. You just make sure you don't interfere with it. And then you get to the default state of the mind. Some people rightly say, oh, but then I fall asleep. Of course, because you're tired. So many people work too hard. And I'm guilty of that as well. Venerable Chanda is guilty of that. We're all but guilty, as charged, yep. As we all do. But there comes a time you have your retreat. And then what happens on your retreat? When I have my retreat, 15 days, of course, I'm tired. I sleep more than I usually sleep when I'm working. But then the need for sleep gets less and less. I energize. Sleep deficit is paid off. I can feel my body. I know what it needs. And sometimes it tells me, you need a rest. You know, there are other times, please trust your body. Be mindful of it. You know when your body's tricking you. You know when it's telling the truth. There are some times that I've got a free morning and I start to meditate and I ask my body, so what do you want? And it says, please, 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 take a sleep. I slept last night. Please, please, please. And I listen to my body. It's not every day. I'm not sort of a sleepaholic. I work hard. But when it says that, I have the opportunity. I go into my cave and lay down. And it's amazing. As soon as you hit the pillow, you're gone. You know, you're in sort of a very deep sleep. 45 minutes, an hour, you just come out. And it feels just so great. And then I find that monks in the monastery, they've all started to get colds and flus, but not me. And believe it or not, I'm a pretty healthy monk. And that's one of the reasons I am healthy. I listen to my body. And sometimes it says, take a rest now so we can fix up this virus or something which is starting to get into your body. And I said, listen to my body. If I really need to sleep, I'll go to sleep straight away. But if I lay down there and just, you know, sleep doesn't come, I say, well, you got it wrong. You didn't need to sleep. That was just indulgence. The mind was tricking you. But when that happens, you have this deep sleep because you listen to your body. Your body really just gets pretty healthy. So anyway, that's where you get aware of like the power of stillness and how your body is always teaching you, always telling you what it needs. If you can only listen to it. And sometimes it's a rest. And after a while, since you don't need that extra sleep anymore because the sleep deficit has been worn off. And then you just sit down and the body wants to sit down, just wants to meditate. So mentioned to people just a few moments ago in the interviews, when it comes to, say, breath meditation, I never go out, breath, come over here. I never treat my breath like a slave or like a maid, like a servant. I treat my breath with the utmost respect as one of my best friends. So what happens is you see my best friend, the breath. Hey, Ajahn Brahm, you've been just going around talking a lot and teaching and stuff. I say, yeah, but I've got an hour off now. Yeah, let's hang out together. And it's like your breath just looks at you and said, yes. I don't go holding on to the breath. We value each other's company. Like you do when you see a really dear old friend. And this one old friend years ago when I went over to UK, I met one of my friends, you know, from college days. And he was the number one, the chief actuary in Europe. And the actuary is like the insurance, but the high-end insurance, working out risks, like an accountant, but much more educated or much more experienced, working out the risks for insurance companies, highly paid, and certified accountants in UK always have to dress very proper. So he had to dress even more proper than proper. So, he's supposed to have a good reputation. But as soon as I saw him, and as we met up, "Hey, Flash, how are you doing?" He said, "Ajahn Vuong, please don't use that word." Because that was his nickname at college. Because what happened, at one party, he got a bit drunk, he went to the toilet to relieve himself, and he came out without his trousers. And his first name was Harold, so he became Flash Harry. He said, "Look, I'm a highly respected, conservative, upright accountant." I was laughing all over my face. He didn't really mind, because it's just the words we used to use as students. And I hadn't seen him for about 25 years or something. And then we started chatting. And I'm not a chatterbox. But I was amazed that for this conversation, I was talking to him for about 3 hours, non-stop. And even the only reason I had to stop, I had to go and give a talk at the Thai temple in Wimbledon. And I couldn't understand why that was. It was just being with a good friend and didn't want to leave. And that's like a feeling with the breath. My breath and I are just really dear old friends. So we just hang out together. When my breath sees me, I see my breath. I don't have to keep it, hold it. It just stays with me. I don't treat it like a maid or a slave. It's my friend. With that attitude, it's easy to watch the breath and be still. Anyway, right stillness. This is supposed to be the word of the Buddha, not the word of Ajahn Brahm. I'm sorry. "I remember a time when my father was occupied while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree." Cool shade, that's an important point. It was comfortable. "Having passed beyond the five senses and free from unwholesome states, I entered and abided in the first jhana. And I thought, could that be the path to awakening? Then the realization arose, that jhana indeed is the path to awakening." That's from the Majjhima 36. Now, it wasn't within the jhana he had that thought, it was after he emerged from it. Could that be the path to awakening? Not could this be the path to awakening, because inside of jhana you are too still to say anything. That's why many people, if when you're in a deep state of meditation, if the thought comes, "Is this a jhana?" then that's a sure sign it ain't. If afterwards, "Was that a jhana?" Yeah, that could have been. So, the description, the four jhanas. "Having abandoned the five hindrances." This is more than restraining the five hindrances or lessening them. This is totally, they're gone. "Totally free from the five senses. Free from unwholesome states. You enter upon and abide in the first jhana, wherein the mind moves on to the object and holds on to it." I mentioned that earlier, that's that vitakka vichara. The last part, subverbal movement, which if it was stronger, would lead to a thought, but doesn't mature and become strong enough to deserve being called what we say is thinking. "The object being the joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses." That's where the ecstasy comes from. Because these five senses, the seeing or sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, it can be very irritating. And you can't control it. There's always something I mention. There's something in my body which I have to scratch or move. Sounds. There's always some sound, and I can't control the sound outside. And smells. So after a while, it's just an irritation. When it stops, that's bliss. On that one time at Mahindarama Temple, when I was staying in a room opposite one of the, not Kampa Road, it was the back part of that road. And it was December the 25th. And the house on the opposite side of the road was having a Christmas party. And they decided, those Christians, they decided to celebrate Christmas by getting drunk and singing karaoke. And I just finished the evening talk and questions and answers, got back to my room about 10 o'clock, really tired and want to have a nice rest. And what happened? Karaoke, really loud, on the house opposite. And the later into the night it gets, the worse the singing becomes. If you can call it singing, it's more like monsters wailing. But then finally, maybe just past midnight, they stopped. That was bliss. At last, quiet, and I could go to sleep. When suffering ends, that's bliss. When the five senses stop, that's the ecstasy of the first jhana. In the first jhana, five things are absent, five factors are present. When one has entered the first jhana, the five hindrances are totally absent. That means no doubt. You know, this is amazing, this is wonderful. No sloth and torpor, you're fully awake, no restlessness, the mind is poised, still. And also, the joy and pleasure being, and also no wanting. You can't want anything, this is more than you'd ever expect to satisfy you. And lastly, just no ill will, you're totally content. And what is present, the mind moves onto the object, holds onto it, the object being joy and pleasure, and there is a oneness of mind. One peak of mind I should have put there. That's good enough, oneness. When the mind no longer moves onto the object because it lets go of holding onto it, you enter upon abiding the second jhana, which has trust in the object of the bliss enough to let go of holding onto it, and a unity of mind without any movement or holding, with the joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. That is where the mind really is still. Nothing moves. No movement at all. And it's not effort holding it, because effort always, even like say, holding it and trying to be still. Anybody who's an anatomist or knows about the body knows that the muscles metabolize all the time. There's always movement. You know, blood, even blood going through the arteries and veins, and all that metabolism, just the energy being used by the muscles, that is always movement. You can never hold this absolutely still. When you let it down, let it go, then it's the first time in your existence or your life you can remember real stillness, when nothing moves. And that is actually bliss. Powerful. And with the fading away of joy, this is what is pleasure, joy. Half of that is vanishing. Your more refined understanding of what happiness truly is. You abide mindful and fully aware. You have to say that there, that sometimes people think in these jhanas there's no mindfulness, no awareness at all, that you are sort of like in a trance state, but you couldn't be further from the truth. You are more mindful, more aware than you've ever been in your life. Well, you know, just really the usual states, because there's more awareness coming yet. But you are still. Nothing moves. And you experience a bliss purified from joy. You enter upon an abiding in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce one has a pleasant abiding. who has such mindfulness and equanimity. And having abandoned all, this is the summary, having abandoned pleasure and pain, all experience from the five senses before entering the jhana, and with the disappearance of joy and unhappiness, all Vedana from the sixth sense except for equanimity, you enter upon the abiding of fourth jhana, which is only this neutral mental experience remaining, just pure mindfulness with equanimity. Pure mindfulness, you can't get higher mindfulness than in that fourth jhana, totally still. And it's usually the case, this is not said here by the Buddha, that is so still, so stable, it usually lasts for hours. And personally, I can't imagine that being in such a state of fourth jhana just for half an hour or 5 minutes, that seems to be impossible for me. Really stable, not moving. So that's a deep state of peace. Yeah.
First jhana, oneness of mind, and the second jhana, unity of mind, is the same?
Exactly, yes. It's all coming together. You know, the ekagata. So, coming together, how? And I that didn't stay here. But it's not just oneness in space, because space is just not really relevant at that time. It's oneness in time. It doesn't change for hours. It's that stable. That singleness in time, not in space. You're focused, but space disappears, basically. Vanishes, you're not really aware. That's not, you're in the mind. And the stillness, it endures for long periods of time. Bliss, it's the bliss which gives it the huge energy, superpower, mega power mindfulness, fully aware, but nothing moves. Yes? If vitakka vichara is the movement of the mind onto the objects holding it. But so the Buddha described that it is the sound, is the they called it the thorn. It can penetrate into the weakest form of the first jhana. In other words, if you see a person who is in the jhanas and it's time for the bus to take them back to Singapore, to the airport rather, how do you get them out? Yes, you can lift them up, put them in the bus, put them in the cargo hold, and they arrive in Singapore, take them out, and they come out of jhana in Singapore, but there's a lot of trouble there with immigration and customs. But to get them out, you know, you talk into their ear. To actually to get them out of the jhana. Remember was it your auntie who was in the coma? Yeah. Was it your auntie or your mum or what?
My auntie, my dad's sister.
Oh, your dad's sister, yeah, your auntie. I mean, she was told this story, I think, the first global conference. And she was in a coma in one of the hospitals in Singapore.
No, in Ipoh.
In Ipoh, okay, in Ipoh. And close enough. And if I get the story wrong, please interrupt. But the doctor apparently just was giving up hope on her.
14 days.
14 days it was, yeah.
Of coma.
Coma, yeah. And apparently that the doctor was asking the children, should we turn off the life support? And asked the sons, Chinese culture. And then they said, well, it should be the eldest son decides. And imagine, the eldest son has to take responsibility to make that decision. He said, no, look, help me. Your decision, your call. Now, what had happened, I don't know how long before, but their mum had come out of the coma but was not able to say or speak or move anything. But the reason I tell that story was because I remember her saying it was the sound of like a temple bell, which drew her out from that deep, dark space back into conscious awareness again. Classic sound, taking you out from those deep states of mind. And eventually that she said, again, she willed her son. I'm still here, don't turn off the ventilator. And that's all she could do, to will and son, don't do it. And then the son thought and thought, give her one more day. And of course, I remember her saying to her face, thank you, son. And of course, in that 24 hours, she managed to show some signs of movement that something was happening. And she eventually made a full recovery, but just learning how to walk again, speak again, and all those things. But the reason I brought that up is because it's a sound that brings you out. But if it's a very deep meditation, you can't even hear those sounds. But that's always the case, that give it a try. If someone's in deep meditation, you call into their ear, hey, it's time to come out. Not loudly, because that would really sort of disturb them, but softly. Bring them back out into this world of the five senses. Oops, what did I do there? So anyway, that is how sound can penetrate. But if it is a strong jhana, it might come out, but you go straight back in again, because it's such a beautiful, there's nothing between you and those jhanas, and you can go straight back in. But then after a while, you get too deep, even in first jhana, for sound to actually to disturb you. And again, it's what's one of the reasons that I know people say, oh, you're blissed out, you can still hear things. If you really hear things, it's not the jhana. So it has to be the five senses totally disappeared. Okay, so that was the fourth jhana, and of course I've lost my pace again, as usual. Here we go. No, close. Here we go. And there we go. And as I mentioned this morning, when you get to Majjhima 108, after the fourth jhana is explained. And what kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? This is called the Gopakamogalana Sutta 108. Totally free from the five senses, you abide in the first jhana. When the mind starts moving on to the joy and pleasure and stops holding it, you abide in the second jhana. With the fading away of joy, you abide in the third jhana. With the abandoning of all mental pleasant and unpleasant vedana, you abide in the fourth jhana. The Buddha only praises four kinds of meditation. It's very powerful, but that's the meditation that the Buddha said we should do, the jhanas. Yeah.
How do you transition from nimitta to jhana?
Again, how you transition is like
nimitta.
Yeah.
From nimitta, because in jhana you can't see anything.
Indeed, yes. So the nimitta is the mental image. The bliss, the joy, is what grows and grows and grows, gets stronger and stronger, and you're paying less attention to any idea of a light, or a disc, or a moon or anything, and the joy takes over. It's like a simile, which, hard to get these similes, but this one I got from, was it Alice in Wonderland or Alice with Looking Glass, the Cheshire Cat. And in this Cheshire Cat, in the original story of Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, this cat started appearing and then disappearing very quickly on the branch of a tree. And Alice said, it is quite sort of irritating that you come and go so quickly. And so the cat said, okay, I will disappear slowly. And then the cat, for its body disappeared, and then its ears disappeared, and its whiskers disappeared, and its eyes disappeared, and then its mouth was the only thing left, smiling mouth, which is a Cheshire Cat, has a smiley type of mouth. And then the mouth disappeared. leaving only the smile. To which Alice replied, "I've often seen a cat without a smile. This is the first time I've seen a smile without a cat." A disembodied smile. Happiness without anything being happy. So it's nice, weird stuff. But that's the case of what happens when you get into these mind states. It's happiness without an emitter, brightness without a light. So this is what happens naturally. And as I think I mentioned, it's a bliss which takes you from the world of nimittas into the world of the jhanas. It's the first time you do these things, it's scary. And I just tried to make a picture of what it feels like, is that you're on the edge and you can see like incredible bliss. Just, you know, it's right in front of you, just one step and you're there. But it's scary because so much of what you've known you have to abandon. And, you know, nimittas can be very scary and powerful, but at least you've got some sort of ways you can think and come and go or get out or something. There's still the ability is there, the option. But you know, if you go that one step more, you'll be in these jhana realms, and there you can't do very much at all. It's one of the reasons why that monk was there for, was it, 8 days? The trick is, if ever you want to know how to deal with these things, is you make a resolution before you go in. I'm going to stay for 4 hours or 10 hours. I've got to come back by when is your flight this evening? So when you make the resolution, you come out almost to the minute, which is weird. So, but when you go in these things without any resolution, you're in there for I don't know how long, until it basically the energy wears out and you come out again. So you know it's a dangerous in the sense of you can miss appointments and it's no control. So that is scary. So there's the bliss, and there you are in nimittas, and there's the bliss, and in the end, I don't know, maybe because you're a hedonist, you like pleasure. Sometimes people say, it must be so tough being a monk. Are you kidding? It's the most pleasurable life I can know. I'm a good time monk. I have a good time. It's weird because people think, oh, it's so tough being a monk, you have to give up so much. Yeah, give up so much, but when you get jhanas, ooh, who wants sex? Who wants drugs? Who wants rock and roll? Anyway, so there you have this beautiful, attractive bliss, and after a while you just say, I'm going for it. And it pulls you in against your fear. The pleasure of what's going to happen, which you know it's that right there, that overcomes any sort of fear. And you just enter and have a wonderful time. When you come out, oh, that was worth it. So that's actually how you make the transition. You don't make the transition, it draws you in. Pulls you in. Many people, when they have nimittas, have the feeling something's pulling you in, pulling you closer into some amazing states. And you just can't resist it. And please don't resist it. It's entirely good. Anyway, here we go. There are chunda. Oh my goodness, where did that time go? These four kinds of life devoted to pleasure that are entirely conducive to repulsion, fading away, cessation, peace, realization, awakening to nirvana. The four kinds of life devoted to pleasure which are conducive to awakening nirvana, what are they? The four jhanas. So if this is from the Digha Nikaya, Sampasadika Sutta. So if devotees of other sects, other religions, should say that these Buddhists are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking, you should tell them, yes. They'll be speaking rightly of you. You're jhana junkies. instead of like addicts, jhana junkies were just, you know, that sort of JJ, it sort of kinds of fits. So anyway, where was I? Yeah, you say yes for those speaking correctly about you. Then some people might further ask you, what benefits can you expect from a life attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking? You should reply, they can expect only four fruits, four benefits. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, full awakening. These are the benefits you can expect from being attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking. Why does the spiritual life have to be suffering? This is actually a very potent teaching. Enlightenment fading away with huge amounts of pleasure and bliss. Not all jhana, every moment of the day, empowers you, gives you the energy, the strength and the insights to serve people in the world and take as many as you can with you out of samsara. Just like the Buddha. And Majjhima 64, this or what is the only path? And this is from the, how was it? 64, the something Malunkyaputta Sutta. There is one path only, Ananda, one way to the abandoning of the five basic fetters. This is where you abandon the five fetters and become a non-returner. It is, and it's so powerfully said. It's really hard that anyone can actually look at this sutta and realize and say that jhanas aren't important or that you can become enlightened without jhanas. This is the five basic fetters. There's five other fetters afterwards. It is impossible that anyone can even understand these fetters, can understand what they are, let alone abandon these five basic fetters. And one of those is the personality view, the Sakkaya Ditti. Without relying on that path, no more than it is possible to cut out the heartwood from a tree without first cutting through its bark and sapwood. And when I first heard that, of course, I thought, there must be some way the Buddha never thought of to get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and sapwood. Maybe you can go through the roots or something and sort of suck it out. You can melt it down with some sort of solvent, pull it out through the roots, and then reconstitute it on the outside. Being a scientist, you always find some sort of loophole or something, but you can't do it that way. There's only one way to get the heartwood from a tree is actually go through the bark and the sapwood. And they said, what is that path? The four jhanas and the first three immaterial attainments. That's the only path to get and understand the five basic fetters, which some of you may know, the five samyojanas, the five fetters, which is, you know, personality view, the view of a permanent essence, the idea that our rites and rituals, chanting by themselves, can be the path to nirvana. The fact that skeptical doubt, that's also one of the hindrances. Those are all like wrong views. And the other two are craving and ill will. You don't even know what those truly are, says the Buddha, let alone abandon them without going through the jhanas. Ooh. And while you still do not experience the jhana, the five hindrances, together with discontent and weariness, invade your mind and remain. But when you do experience the jhana, the five hindrances, discontent and weariness, do not invade your mind and remain. It's not just getting rid of the five hindrances, it's discontent. So that's one of the reasons why. If a person comes up to me and they say, I've just had a first jhana, what I do, and please excuse me, and they say to you, and say you just experienced a first jhana. Say, I'm sorry, but women who live in France just cannot get jhanas. And I wait to see if you react. Like, what are you saying that for? That's misogynist. That's racist. That's... Okay, that wasn't a jhana, for sure. But if you say, okay, well, it doesn't matter. If you're just so peaceful and so still and so... I say, whoa, well done. Congratulations. I probably was. You try and find somebody's weak point to try and make them disconnect, content, but you just can't do that if someone's in a jhana. You can't make them discontent. They're just blissing out and happy little meditators. Or the weariness. You get this boost of energy. If you get into a jhana tonight, you're not going to sleep tonight. You don't want to sleep. You're just full of energy. Wow, just healthy energy too. And you don't need to sleep. Your mind's got this huge boost of power. And of course, no hindrances. And even more than this, the insights. Please excuse me for pushing these jhanas, but I respect you. And I thought it was just really not on to not teach good people what the Buddha taught. I get nothing out of this, but except that some of you either now or later or some future life will actually experience his jhanas. And, you know, I played a little part in it, but just saying it's possible and what they are, and they're good to do. When you have no jhana, for one deficient in jhana, the cause for seeing things as they truly are is destroyed. Seeing things as they truly are, insight. When you do not see things as they truly are, for one deficient in such wisdom, the cause for repulsion fading away is destroyed. When you are not repulsed or inclined to disappear, for one deficient in these, the cause for knowledge and vision of liberation is destroyed. And the Buddha is saying, develop jhana. When you experience jhana, you can understand things as they really are. And what you understand as it really is? The origin and passing away of form, the origin and passing away of experience, the origin and passing away of perception, the origin and passing away of the will, the origin and passing away of consciousnesses, the five khandhas. And I mentioned this earlier, but it's a nice little saying. Verse 372, there is no jhana for one without wisdom. Wisdom is wisdom power, letting go, compassion, kindness. Being even with the breath, not with force, but with the wisdom and kindness of looking upon your breath like a really good friend. Like the simile of the lotus. I think many of you know, how do you open up a lotus to get right inside this body and mind and get into the jhana's realms? They're right inside of you. You go in to get those jhanas. That's why it's no exaggeration to say each one of you here has got jhanas. They're inside, you just need to open up, let go of all those other coverings until that beautiful heart of you is actually seen. And the inside. So you open up with awareness and kindness, the light and warmth of the sun. And patience, be mindful, be kind, and you go inside. There is no jhana for one without wisdom. There is no wisdom for one without jhana. For one who has both jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. Those two beautiful things. That's verse 372. Yeah. Okay, they are special cases of the fourth jhana. Now, okay, so imagine how I've been teaching so far. You are so still in the fourth jhana. Nothing is moving. I mean, really, even the first jhana, you're pretty still, but there's still a bit of a wobble. The second jhana, almost perfect stillness, but the joy is something you never expected that would not be pure. And then the sukha, the mental pleasure, the other flavor of delight in the third jhana, that disappears and it's just so pure and still in the fourth jhana. Where there is stillness, things fade away. Just like your eyes, when they are closed and they're seeing the inside of the eyelids, after a while, they turn off. Just the other senses, and even your mind, mind consciousness. If you don't click the mouse, if you don't touch anything, your computer turns off. Now your mind is turning off. The stages of the mind ceasing. The sixth consciousness. Little by little, we don't measure things in space, extension. Sometimes they call that the boundless space. Boundless, that doesn't make any sense. It is just one of those elements, space and consciousness, which they say in just the, they make a lot of, as what are the two extra elements, as well as the four elements. Yeah, but I don't like calling it infinite. I call it immeasurable. Or without boundaries. Because, you know, just in math, in mathematics, so the dot and infinity are just closely related. Nothingness and everything. And the simile I tried to use, you know, from a basic experience of meditation, when you've ever got into present moment awareness, when you really got into present moment awareness, you're right now, it's like no extension of time. Minutes, hours don't make any sense. To actually to have a length of time, you need now and in the future, or the past to now, or the past to future. You need more than just the now to actually have time as we measure it. So this tiny, now almost nothing time, a point of time, it's got no extension. But the experience of the present moment is just timeless. It's infinity time, it's unmeasured time, unmeasurable time, like no time. It's when space is vanishing. Because we, without measuring it, it disappears. And the next, the second arupa is again a just boundless consciousness or unmeasurable consciousness, immeasured. In other words, it's about to disappear. It's both nothing and infinite. It's about to go. And so consciousness vanishes. And what's left? Nothing. But you're aware there's nothing. Now you get into some of the most refined states. You're going into the lotus and the petals there are almost so thin, it's hard to know whether they really exist or not. But you know nothingness. Now this is not a concept. This has come after going through all those jhanas. Your consciousness is fading away. You're not sitting outside watching through the window and seeing this happens. You are that nothingness. And so what's happening here is your mind is really fading now. And that's the most refined thing which they say that you can use for insight. Because after that, it's neither perception nor non-perception. Even the awareness of nothing disappears. So there's no awareness, no perception left. But you're perceiving there's no perception. From one angle, the mind has stopped. From the other angle, you know it stopped. So it's not really stopped yet. And they say that is so subtle that it's, you can't really use that as a point where you can recognize and remember. It's just too refined for that. But after that, then the mind stops. And that's called the cessation of perception and feeling. Sanya Vedayita Nirodha. You have vanished. Everything which you ever thought you were, the body, your will, your perceptions, your memories, your even your consciousnesses have totally disappeared. And so obviously that this is the final vanishing. But it's not really final because then, people ask, and it's a tough question to answer, then why don't you just disappear then? It's because the karma just draws you out even. The machine starts again. And you go backwards through neither perception or non-perception. Then you become aware of nothingness. And then sort of infinite consciousness and or unbounded confidence and unmeasurable consciousness and then unmeasurable space and then into the fourth jhana and then out the way you came. The mind and the perceptions, the feelings, the senses turn on again. When you come out of that, whoa, you're really full of energy. Blissed out. You've just been to some amazing places. And it's not mentioned here, but in the Chula Hatipadopama Sutta, which I always wondered, that was the first sermon which the Arahat Mahinda, when he landed in Sri Lanka, taught to the King Dewanampiya Tis. Why did he teach that? And there you see the simile, the elephant's footprint. You only know it's a really big tusker, not because you know, you see the damage to the trees, but when you see first of all the first signs are the big footprints. And when you see the elephant sitting there under the tree. And he said, these are the footprints of the Buddha, the place where the Buddha stayed. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. And so it's not my own invention. But if you really want to go to the four holy places, the place where the Buddha spent most of the time, it's not the material places. It's not the four holy places of Lumbini and Bodh Gaya and Sarnath and Kusinara. It's the first, second, third, fourth jhanas. That's where the Buddha spent most of the time. It's an experiential world, the mind world. And when you realize that, and if ever any one of you have had any jhanas at all, and you realize that what you experienced this morning, yeah, we did the imagine you're the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. And that's pretty cool. Imagine you actually enter one of these jhanas. Now, it's not imagination. Your mental experience, your experience right there, is no different at all than the experience of a Buddha, of an Arahat, of an Ajahn Chah, and all these great beings, all the great nuns, Patachara. Your experience is exactly the same. You really are standing in the footprints of a Buddha. And that just, even just me saying that now, brings goosebumps. You experience the mind of a Buddha. No different. Except when you come out, then the difference happens. But in there, side there, it's the same. So if you want to know what the Buddha, what it's like to be a Buddha, what it felt like, how he lived, it's not just visiting here, visiting there. It's you right there. Experience, the same experience as the Buddha, as one of the great Arahats. They're all great. And there, that really inspires you. And I could say, this is only monks and nuns' business. But that's, I just don't like that. My egalitarian streak says, no. The Buddha taught that to lay people, lay men and lay women in the time of the Buddha. I already mentioned that Chitta, he got these jhanas and enjoyed them. You have the, what's it called, Gatikara, the potter. He was doing these jhanas. Okay, previous Buddha, but why not? And just to say it's possible, that it can be done in your life, that takes away many barriers. Don't say you will do it, but you can. Who knows? One day, as many people said, because when the first lay people I taught, I didn't know whether I was teaching the right thing. Is this going to work? Is it, I'm just wasting my time. It's just lay people, they can't achieve jhanas or whatever. I don't know. Let's experiment, try it. But of course it worked. Lay people did. And then I remember asking the first couple, you know, just, what did you do special this time? Why did you get these jhanas? And the first one has said this. And the second one has said it. The third one said exactly the same thing. You know what they said? I really let go. And that just really hit me. I never asked again. Because I said, yeah, exactly. You really let go. Sometimes we think we're letting go. No, we're just keeping a bit back. Just in case. You really let go. So one day you'll do that and say, well, what the hell, I'm going to really let go. And you really let go of the one letting go, everything, just let go and see what happens. And then you find you are sitting in the footsteps, or standing in the footsteps of a Buddha. You're sitting on the Buddha's seats, the four jhanas. Whoa. Okay, sorry I keep going on like this, but I get inspired as well. Sadhu, I call it indulgence. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay.